For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source of horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you are looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust and Who's Not, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com, and let's make that clear. It's DiabolikDVD.com.
Severin Films presents Blood and Flesh, the real life and ghastly death of Al Adamson, now available on digital platforms, Amazon, Vudu, iTunes, Google Play, and more. The award-winning documentary from the makers of The Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau, Blood and Flesh tells the sometimes hilarious, sometimes shocking story of a B-movie maverick, Al Adamson, who was found murdered at his ranch in the desert in the mid-90s. Blood and Flesh is also available as part of the massive Al Adamson Masterpiece Collection box set, 32 movies on 14 discs with special features and exclusive new 126-page book. Classic, newly remastered Adamson films include Dracula vs. Frankenstein, Satan's Sadist, a personal favorite, Carnival Magic, Heart of the Blood Monsters, Black Samurai, The Naughty Stewardesses, and many more. The Al Adamson Masterpiece Collection from www.severin-films.com. Also available for pre-order from Severin, Kids, When the Wind Blows, the animated feature on the Blu-ray, to Scar a New Generation. Based on the graphic novel by Raymond Briggs, with music by Roger Waters and David Bowie, it's Threads for Kids. Whew, that's brutal. Los Angeles Severin fans, join us for the return of the Severin Super Shock Pop-Up Film Festival on March 28th at the Montalban Theater in Hollywood. Sneak previews of forthcoming titles on the big screen, future release trailers and short film teaser, exclusive gift bags, and more. Tickets available at eventbrite.com.
Tonight's show is also brought to you by Wellgo Entertainment. From the writer and director of I Saw the Devil comes the film with bone-crunching, blood-spurting action, says Birth Movies Death. The Witch Subversion is a serious revenge thriller with kick-ass bloody action. Now available on digital, Blu-ray, and DVD. Again, that is The Witch Subversion from Wellgo Entertainment. Tonight's episode is also brought to you by Fangoria. It's 2020, and Fangoria magazine is back on the shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from all the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much, much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use promo code Shockwaves for 15% off right now. Again, that's promo code Shockwaves for 15% off.
It's 181 Shockwaves.
The final Shockwaves.
We don't know. I mean, we're back.
Oh, I know.
We're back at the Blumhouse offices now.
We're all into quarantine.
We're doing okay for now.
This is the final broadcast. If you are hearing our voices, this is the last. Follow the beacon. Follow the light, guys.
Maybe as everyone goes into quarantine, we will be that voice on the radio. We will be like the pump up the volume voice,
Stevie
where it's
Williams.
Like the voice of a nation. That's us, guys. We're going to be the voice broadcasting out of that.
I want to be as sultry as Stevie Wayne.
Only those who have touched my face survive. The rest of you are doomed. You're immune from the Omega Man.
Elric is like one of those toads that you lick the back of.
Exactly.
Oh, he's got like healing properties.
This has all just been a trip.
I don't think those toads have healing properties, Ryan. Don't try that at home,
what,
guys.
They don't?
No.
Oh, shit.
Richard Stanley told me otherwise.
I've been doing it all wrong.
There's now at least 5 Facebook ads that you can cure corona by licking toads. Good job, Ryan. Good job.
But if you take a meteor.
Fake news.
A meteorite and take the blood and put it on your eyes, you will be okay, Elric. Right?
All right.
Well, we're recording in very strange times.
That went great.
Yes. If this is your first time listening, welcome.
Believe it or not, goodbye.
I'm Rob G. Elric Kane is with me.
He was, yes. Past tense.
Ryan Turek is back.
I was
welcome.
Here. Hi.
We missed you the last couple of weeks.
I know.
Especially Severn offices.
I know. Every time you guys go on a field trip and get free stuff, I'm always out.
Yeah.
Becca, oh my God.
Oh my God, that's
cover
like,
that's Becca McKendry over there.
I just like turned my whole body around and coughed at the corner.
This is all normal for Becca.
This is all I do, guys.
She's got it.
I have asthma.
Wow. Okay, so yeah.
We hope everybody is safe and sound.
Yeah.
And taking care of themselves.
I don't think that the rest of, well, I don't know. So LA, as we tape this, LA is kind of going on lockdown, to put it lightly.
Whoa. Hold on a second. Lockdown is what happened in New Rochelle, where this National Guard came in and
multiple places that I work throughout the day have all closed.
It's a two-hour show, Ryan. By the end of the show, we could be on lockdown. That's what we're getting at. The situation is changing as we speak.
Everybody's taking preventative measures.
They're closing schools
and everything.
Nastiness, but I don't think it's quite at that point in other areas of the country. So, yeah.
I'm with Bill Paxton on this one.
What did Bill Paxton say?
Game over, man. Game over.
Oh, God.
All right.
Oh,
but as of now, everyone's okay. Stay away from those movies that Ryan thinks you should watch during these times. I say don't watch pandemic movies.
Oh, I absolutely know. Ciara, 2 weeks ago, she goes, I want to watch Outbreak.
No, you don't.
I was like, really?
No.
I remember, here's the strange thing. When I worked a Stop and Shop in Connecticut, and it was around the time, I think it was like on a break from college. So it was like that weird in between where I went to school in New York City for my freshman year of college. And then it came, you had to go home for the summer. So that was always a weird summer.
That was
always a weird summer. But I had a crush on the girl that worked in the video store. There was a video store attached to Stop and Shop. And I remember like Outbreak came out during that time. But then I also learned that she had like this weird obsession with AIDS. Like she was just like strangely like, she was super goth and she was really cute, but I was like, oh, whatever. But then she remembered, she was like, I'm just kind of like so fascinated by AIDS and how it works. And I was like, I am not at all. And you are really freaking me out, but you're really cute and you're goth. And then I remember Outbreak had come out and my buddy Angela was like, yo, let's go see Outbreak. And I was thinking, do I bring AIDS girl? Do I not? Does she like, will she like just sort of get riled up by the fascination of viruses and diseases? And I chose not to. Wow. And I did not go on that date. Oh. But I did see Outbreak that night. Well, I'm getting to my point. And it terrified the shit out of me.
Oh, yeah.
Because, it was just like, it was just a hot spot time for that kind of stuff. It was like hot zone.
Yeah, because it was, the hot zone had just come out. I remember reading that. But I was talking in my classes yesterday, we're now closed down, but the idea of it being too soon, of, you know, can you watch pandemic horrors right now and be cool with it? And they have this pandemic documentary that just came to Netflix. It's like 6 episodes.
Ernie's shaking his head.
Ernie can't do it.
We're on the same page. We're looking at each other.
We're like, nope.
Pandemic documentary on Netflix, I made it through the first episode, which was very much about the Spanish flu in the early 1900s. And it was very much like I was watching it with this separation of, well, that won't happen again. And then the second episode was all about how this is going to happen again. And I had to turn it off midway through because I was like, this is making me really sad.
Well, yeah, that I can completely get. Mm-hmm. But something like Outbreak, which is like Wolfgang Peterson, big Hollywood movie, Dustin Hoffman, Rene Russo, a very young Kevin Spacey.
Wasn't Cuba Gooding in there?
Cuba Gooding Jr.
I want that sound he just made on like a sound file so we can just run
that's
it
my
out
Kevin,
all the
that's
time.
My, that's my Kevin Spacey pulling up my collar, like kind of like, no. But, you know, watching Outbreak, I only got halfway through before I fell asleep. She finished watching it. But I was just sitting there just kind of like, chuckling because it's so big.
And it was exciting at the time. It felt like an exciting movie.
But it was also like, you know, they're trying to inject like this kind of mood of high adventure. We need to get ahead of this virus. And then Wolfgang Peterson's doing camera trickery where someone's hacking away in a movie theater and you're following the germ particle as it goes out the guy's mouth through the theater into the vents.
Into the vents of the hospital. It was a cool shot.
Alamo Drafthouse should use that as its opening for every movie right now. Welcome to the Drafthouse. Yeah.
I mean, like stuff like that, I don't mind revisiting. But the thing you're talking about, I just don't.
It's too
intense.
What's
the Soderbergh one?
Kate Winslet's Contagion.
Contagious
is that one's so depressing but that and bleak one, anyway. Yeah,
it's so bleak.
And so it's, I couldn't
but
even
that
imagine
opening, that. I was discussing it with somebody yesterday and it almost feels real now, where if you remember that opening, it comes from a bat pig banana. Where a bat is eating like a piece of fruit, like a banana or something. It falls off the tree. The pig eats it, and then the pig gets served in the restaurant, and then
to Gwyneth Paltrow
gets it. And so,
don't eat pigs eaten by Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah,
especially if they're pig bats.
Didn't she just recently make some sort of like goop? Vagina? Goop.
That's goop.
But what is the
honey,
point
she
of that?
Made the vagina egg like a decade ago. That's
no, some sort of perfume.
We've all been through the vagina.
But wasn't
egg
it
by
like
now.
A perfume or something weird? It was really recently.
She made Goop.
What is Goop?
It's a show on Netflix in a massive, like, huge, enormous industry for, like, alternative healing.
Doesn't sound like her. Let's skip it.
It's not in any capacity.
But her death in Contagion is horrifying.
Yeah. It is. It is hard. Contagion is, it's a very bleak one. It's Soderbergh's version
of
Outbreak.
Well, he retired after. I was at the DGA watching that when he did it, and the movie ends, he goes, and I'm retiring. That was my last movie. And I was like, wow, what a downer to go. And of course, he's made like 7 films.
Yeah. Wow. So much retirement.
Yeah. But hopefully this passes up. hopefully we'll still have humanity.
So you tell us, are you into Contagion movies during this time or not?
Or do you like zombie movies during this time, which are kind of like an approximate, but at least with a fantastic element.
Or could you do like funnier infection movies? Things like Shivers
Funnier?
Funnier. Okay, Shivers isn't funny. But there's funnier infection movies like Dead Alive. Yeah. Or
but they're not infection. Oh, yeah, yes, it is. Yeah,
but like the Japanese film I was talking about from the Tartanation Extreme ones last week, Infection.
Is that one funny?
It's not funny. It's over the top.
Oh, okay.
It's over the top gory. I would never laugh during it, but it definitely, because it is so gory, it separates you.
I'm very excited to watch Contamination.
Okay. Yeah.
The Italian.
I always found that around really boring.
Yeah, that's kind of a slug. Really cool effects, though. A little bit of a slug. But hey, we all watched one of the director's other films, right?
Luigi Cozzi.
We watched some Paganini horror.
Severin delivering the goods. Come on. What do you guys think?
Where's my copy?
Wait, you haven't seen it yet?
Thanks for grabbing one.
You can borrow mine. I'll get you.
You haven't watched it?
No, I haven't. No, what do you mean I haven't watched it? I wasn't part of the homework.
That was. Do you read?
Kind of fell apart with the homework.
Do you read the homework assignments, Rye?
I didn't get it.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't. I was on
there might have been a text.
My dog ate it.
I love that Becca's getting for you while we're recording.
Literally.
I
want to
look at it while we were recording.
Oh, I bought the soundtrack. I have the soundtrack.
The soundtrack
came out on vinyl.
Yeah.
The movie,
cool.
Well, the setup for it.
Is it good?
It's something else.
It's something.
That means yes.
And there are parts of it that I really did enjoy, and then there's other parts that I found to be quite slow. Elric, you just watched this one last night. You want to give
you
us
guys made me,
the plot rundown?
Well, you know how.
Ryan coughed.
You guys know how I like a good bonkers movie.
Yes.
This one is not the former, but is somewhat the latter. So it's not good, but it is somewhat bonkers. It's not bonkers in the way that I particularly enjoyed, though. I thought the concept was interesting, this weird piece of music, with like a piece of sheet music from the original Paganini.
Yeah, it was
meet an all-girl band that is singing a hit that sounds, it is basically Bon Jovi.
It is Bon Jovi.
It's totally ripped off by Jovi.
Oh, yeah, when I wrote to him. You Give Love a Bad Name. Yeah.
I said this was what I called this a couple days ago. I wrote to you and I said, this is like a stunt rock west.
Yes.
So it's the Red Rock
and
West of
Ultra. As I was listening to it with this, they do a second song. It's a slow song. You could literally sing Richard Marx along with it.
Oh, yeah,
wherever you go. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, so they're singing two hits, like actual hits. And I just love that the producer in the studio is like, this is garbage. You've lost it. You're terrible.
Yeah.
And so the overreaction response to everything is they're very dramatic in this movie about their hits. And then it's the drummer finds a piece of music from a famous composer or something like that, that apparently...
Paganini.
That's the guy. Yeah.
There we go.
Called the Paganini Horror.
Yeah,
right?
Called the Paganini Horror.
No, the actual title of the song was something like The Witch's Feast or The Witch Sabbath or something like that. Like it had a different name. But they decide that they're going to play this song that has never been heard before, and they're going to make a music video for it in Paganini's old home.
Yeah.
Yes, by a very famous horror director.
Yeah, who everyone loves. Like everyone loves his movies.
Argento
type
is technically directing the music video.
Though he's total milktoast looking dude.
Total. But he was my favorite character.
Everything you're literally saying has me so excited.
Well, get ready for the real fun part.
So the first act, I found the first act, I was like, this is the best setup ever. And even as they get there and they're making the music video, I'm like, this is amazing. And then when it turns into a slasher, it lost me.
Leah Ryan, he's like losing his mind. Wait, we forgot. I'm sorry, we forgot the best part. Guess who sells the piece of Paganini music to
Alice Cooper.
No, even better for you.
Donald Pleasance.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he shows up for a hot
minute. It might even be one of his last movies because he looks pretty out of it.
And he's definitely dubbed. It's not Donald's voice at all. But it's wild.
And then it has this crazy looking killer thing that you see on the front, which is like...
the killer's kind of cool.
Like a weird white mask and a big hat and can't sign off on this. This for me is not approved.
But I'm did you have fun? Was it entertaining? That's
I was not entertained.
Wow.
I was like a little bit. I was like, at the start, I was entertained. And then I was just like, oh, bored and confused. And the directing, I was raging to her. It's that directing where it's just a wide shot and four people will stand next to each other and have conversations with no actual shots.
It's
and I'm
exactly
like, oh,
what we see when we hand our freshman cameras where they will shoot only in wide with no blocking.
Yeah,
and everyone just stands there and talks. They did that a lot.
But then I researched.
Luigi Cozy alone.
Well, no. So that I researched afterwards, realizing it was Cozy and going, yeah, every one of the movies I've seen of his have been ones that I've been kind of bored by. And so I don't know. Maybe it's a Cozy thing.
I'm looking at him right now.
Get off his back.
Contamination was one of them. Sorry,
I feel like
to say.
Ryan will enjoy this. I think it's thoroughly entertaining.
I can't wait.
Yeah. I like the soundtrack that comes with the
soundtrack.
Release.
Is great.
Co-written kind of by Daria Nicolidi.
Yes, for
she
sure.
Did something on
this.
It.
This is a CD. Oh, I'm going to listen to on the way home.
I take back everything I've ever said about Luigi Cozy because he did my favorite version of Hercules from 1983 with Lou Ferrigno.
Oh, so, I know someone who's in that.
There you go. And Star Crash.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Star Crash at least is bonkers. Yeah, I don't know. I just, this one, like, I was excited for it because, and the start is good. But yeah, something about this one, I was like, oh, this is going to be such our kind of devil's honey. And it just wasn't for me. Sorry.
There's no, like, crazy moments like that. Yeah. Like, you don't have, like, a saxophone moment by any stretch.
There's a little girl who, like, kills her mom at the start in the opening scene, which was kind of interesting.
Oh, yeah, and that sequence, ties into it later.
That feels a little Kathy's Curse-ish.
Yeah, it did.
The director's name is Mark Singer, by the way.
Yeah.
The hot shot horror director, Mark Singer.
From Beastmaster.
Mark Singer.
Not his real name, his name in the movie. Right. Yeah.
By far my favorite character, because he walks in and it's very much like the, well, I don't know anything about music videos, but in this movie, and he's constantly self-referential. It's fun.
Right on.
So, yeah.
But you know what else came out last week, which we didn't get to talk about? I don't know who's all seen it, but The Invisible Man.
Hell yeah.
I've seen Invisible Man.
We are in the halls of Blumhouse.
Yes.
I've heard it's pretty good.
The Hallowed Halls. This is a very good movie and a very good sign for the rebooting of these dark monster movies.
I have to say, this is definitely, I'm 99% sure, going to be on my top 10 list of the year.
Yeah.
This was so tight.
It's like an inch off upgrades brilliance, but it's in the same trajectory. So good on Lee. He's really crushing it. Mm-hmm. I just loved how real it was. I love that it started with, what's the one with Patrick Bergen and Julie Roberts?
Sleeping with the Enemy.
It opens with the Enemy.
It starts with the greatest opening credits ever.
Yeah.
I love it when people stylize their opening credits. It's like a vested interest.
Yeah, it shows that it's all been thought.
Well, if you stick around at the end of Upgrade or it's beginning of Upgrade, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I know that Lee was adamant about having the credits read by like a computer voice.
Oh, yeah.
See, I love that. Yeah, I love when people stylize the credits and it's not just like text on a screen.
But let's definitely not talk spoilers in case people haven't seen it.
But I do agree. It totally opened Sleeping with the Enemy.
Which is fun because you already, like the one thing is you don't get to see much of like the bad stuff that happened to your character, mm-hmm. but it's because of all the movies before, you don't need it.
Yeah.
It's like you've got a whole cinema of 90s yuppie thrillers that we've talked about before that like get you filled in, and it's a great performance by Moss. She's fantastic in it. And it's, you know, it's really real. And it has some really shocking moments, some surprising moments. And it does the actual, Invisible Man's probably my favorite of the originals.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a totally different kind of movie. This isn't really a remake. It's a total reimagining.
It's nothing to do with it. Yeah.
But I do like the way, how they justify the invisibility, how the things they come. I don't want to ruin that for people to discover, but like how they come up with it in a modern context, I thought really worked well.
Yeah. I like that. I mean, invisibility in general is such a high concept thing, but then to structure it as what is ultimately a house horror.
Mm-hmm.
It's shit, you know, happening in this house and her immediately going, no one ever suspects ghosts. I love that she's never like, I'm being haunted by this guy because we do believe he's dead. It's always, he's still here.
Yeah.
And so the fact, but it is structured ultimately as a house horror. It feels in the same way in that it's escalating and then it goes completely off the rails. And I think that was such a smart approach instead of trying to blow up the world and do something like they kind of did with Mummy, where it was like, you know, whatever's the story. We can do 100,000 times that and make it huge.
I was a little, the one reticent thing I was about before I saw it was having seen the trailer, I felt like I had seen all the story. It felt like one of those trailers that was very clear with all the story beats. And I knew somebody who I asked about it who had seen it. And I said, but it's all of it, right? And they said, no, there's another big part. And I found that really satisfying. Mm-hmm. I think the ending is really satisfying emotionally and is just a great, you know, kind of great, not twist, but just a great ending. And so, yeah, this one couldn't recommend it. You still haven't caught this one yet?
No, I haven't yet.
Okay, so I don't want to talk any spoilers any broader.
Yeah, but I mean, just behind the scenes, Invisible Man was one of those projects. I wasn't on Bea Sekiro, who's the other executive here. That was one of hers. And
Bea's
awesome. And when I read the script for it, I was like, I had heard through the grapevine that Lee had a great take on Invisible Man. And I said, what is it? And they said, it's sleeping with the enemy with the Invisible Man. And I went, oh, yes, nice. Of course. Yeah, that's how you do it. Yeah. And when I read the script, I just felt like it was like Lee firing on all cylinders. It was like, okay, that you're not trying to marry it to a monster universe. You're not trying to do this. You're not trying to do that. You're just telling a very good story, first and foremost. And now we're doing
more good stories.
More good stories. Yeah. And
Karen Kusama announced Dracula potentially.
Yeah, that slipped out into the world yesterday. Karen playing around with Dracula.
Yeah, nice. Which is cool. You want to see these original takes. Yeah. My only suggestion is to do Bride of Frankenstein before you touch Frankenstein. I think you don't need to worry. Everyone's seen Frankenstein, but somebody could jump right into Bride.
Well, that's how we don't look at it. It is. What is the story?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even like thinking ahead of like what other ones we should tackle. What's the filmmaker that's going to come to us and say, I've got this great take on creature.
Yeah, because some of them are hard to divorce in your brain because they're so iconic. It's sometimes Dracula. I can see a million ways because vampires can be, but something like, you're right, creature would be, especially with Shape of Water having been so recently, would be harder.
It's a tough one. But I did, on that note of aquatic horror, because this kind of got me all giddy this week, American Horror Story announced that they are going aquatic horror for the next season.
Is it confirmed they're doing that?
I heard so. At least like 90 people tagged me in posts on Twitter that day.
That's fun.
So it's.
I can't wait. Yeah. I mean, after 1984, I don't know what the hell they're going to do.
I didn't see you finish that season.
I did. I talked about it. On
I knew you watched it, but I didn't know you made
was it
to
good?
The end.
Yeah, I did. Of course, I did. Yeah, I liked it.
It was good.
Yeah. I saw a few things on the festival scene. I had a chance to check out Possessor, Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor.
Yeah, I want
to
see that.
It's difficult to talk about things that are, you know, haven't been released yet into the world. But I will say this is another, I really was a big fan of Cronenberg's Antiviral.
I loved Antiviral. Yeah.
I thought that, you know, the apple had not fallen far from the tree, obviously, and Brandon was channeling. It was kind of like reading Joe Hill's Heart-Shaped Box through the prism of, oh, this is Stephen King's kid, and then seeing how King, you know, Stephen had influenced his son. I felt the same way with Brandon Cronenberg's Antiviral. I was watching, you know that film and seeing a lot of Cronenbergian, you know, thumbprints all over the place.
The whole idea of the body and melding it and everything. But it felt vastly different, too.
But it felt like it was totally Brandon's movie as well. And Possessor is Brandon's, like, 100%. Mm. You know, it is basically Andrea Riseborough basically plays, like, a hitman who is able to with a device, possess people who are near her mark. So she can eliminate them and then jump back out without any evidence that she was the person involved in killing. Cool. And it's really, really great. The other thing I saw is I revisited House on Haunted Hill. My wife and I have been.
Original or 99?
99.
I love that one.
Yeah, it is. We've been in the process of a move, and that was the first movie we tossed on while I was like building endless furniture. And that is a movie that just holds up so fucking well. And William Malone did such a great job. I mean, like in 99, we were still in the thick of Scream knockoffs. And then Dark Castle came along, and I felt like they kind of just shouldered all those Scream knockoffs out of the way and said, don't forget, supernatural horror is still great. Boom, here's House on a Haunted Hill.
And they were doing so much, whereas horror at the time was kind of nervous about CG, I think. They kind of like just kind of sat on it.
Well,
like, we're going to do this.
Yeah, they lean a little too much into the CGI stuff at the very, very end, which I'm an apologist for. I'm just like, okay, fine, I'll give him a pass.
Oh, come on. But the first time Jeffrey Combs runs at you, I mean, it's freaky.
Yeah, no, there's a, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, when they do the kind of weird force
the
processing
thing.
The
twitchy nurses. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot.
I think William Malone was trying to do something cool with it.
Yeah,
where everyone was like, "Oh, CGI." So he's like, "Well, how can we use this?
Yeah, how can we use it? Yeah, and then, you know, and everybody in the cast is so good. It's like Jeffrey Rush, and Famke Janssen, and even Chris Kattan is very, very funny in the movie. Mm-hmm. It's one of those movies that I have it's got a strong place in my heart, and I love revisiting it and love the style, and the soundtrack is really great. It's just a really great film. House on Haunted Hill, which Scream Factory recently put out in a special edition, and I just saw that they announced a 13 Ghosts special edition.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about that.
Where's Taye Diggs?
Taye Diggs? I don't know, man.
Taye Diggs was good back then. I miss you, Taye. It's you, Rob.
What do you got?
I already did them. I mean, I can come back, but you go first.
Yeah. So I did another Severn movie, and this is bonkers and a gem. I'm going to stand by this one. They put something out called Revenge of the Living Dead Girls, and I'd never heard of this. It's just like this cover with three like zombie-looking girls, and we talked about it when we had David Greger on a few weeks ago. And basically, it's a long lost French horror movie from 87 or so. And in the opening, so it's a guy driving a milk truck that pulls over to pick up a girl, a hitchhiker. And she's like, "Oh my God, it hurts right here on my leg." And he's like, "Where?" And he's like, "Right here." And he starts touching her leg. And he's just like, "Let me pull over and I'll just check it a little bit more." And so the milk guy and this girl get out and go and make out in a cave. And while they're doing that, a dude in a motorcycle rolls up and he's like, "What's up? I'm going to drop some poison in this milk." And like literally pours poison in the top
Why?
Of the milk thing. We won't know until much later.
Okay.
So he does that, and then that's the last we see of Milkman. Then we cut to two different instances. There's a girl who's sitting in her bra with her mom having breakfast, drinking a giant glass of milk, who immediately croaks after. And then there's these two girls that are at a bar, like playing pinball machine or whatever, and they drink milkshakes and also die. So all of a sudden there's this whole thing and this conspiracy like, "Oh my God, it wasn't supposed to kill anyone. It was supposed to be just a test to see what would happen, yada, yada." And lo and behold, these three women rise from there. Oh, they try to get rid of the gook. They're like, "All right, get rid of the gook. Where should we get rid of it? At the cemetery." And so they dump it all in the cemetery right on the graves of the three girls, and these three girls come back. And then there's some nasty stuff that they do to people.
Find out how they died and why they want revenge?
Yes, and not only that, because I'm going with it because I'm like, all right, this is crazy. This is definitely – it almost feels like it should be in that Italian horror – kind of like that aesthetic from the 80s, but it's because it's French, it's just a little weirder and a little more off cuff. But yeah, I just kept thinking like, this is a weird movie and I can't believe I've never heard of it or seen of it. And then the ending is so jaw dropping that you're like, oh, okay, all right. The ending kind of makes it even better than it is. Like you won't see it coming.
I'm going to ask you what that ending is offline. Because I don't
want to watch
myself
I want to see it.
I'll tell you guys,
No, I don't want to know.
It's a terrible spoiler.
This sounds fun.
It's a lot of fun. I thought it was a lot of fun. Again, I'd never heard of this movie.
What's the French title?
my fiance is going to kill me. La Revanche del Mortes Vivantes.
That's why I asked.
Has she been teaching you French?
No.
I need
to learn it on my own.
I looked this up on Google, and I always love people also search for because you see it a bit below. So Revenge of the Living Dead Girls, pornographic horror, 1 hour and 35 minutes. People also search for Mutants, The Night Eats the World, The Grapes of Death, and Oasis of the Zombies.
So there's some genre roll-on.
Grapes of Death
there.
Is fun.
Yeah, that's a roll-on.
Well, this is actually – it looks like this is an old – as recently as – Bleeding Skull reviewed it. So this is like one of those oddities. Now, the version I saw looks fantastic. Mm. So it's fully restored and Blu-ray quality and all that. But no, I thought it was a little gem, and really it's one of those things where – Yeah, it's much better than Paganini Horror, which I also find thoroughly entertaining. Yeah. I was entertained by the lunacy of it and kind of the overt sexuality, because I think it even says on the back of the box that they were maybe softcore porn filmmakers that made this thing. So there is a lot of female nudity. But by the ending is just so bonkers that you're like, wait, what? Okay, fine. <Yeah. laughs> So I like it. Revenge of the Living Dead Girls.
Nice, nice. If anybody's got anything else, I just want to give a little mention.
I've got a couple left. Well, but
okay. Okay. Go.
All right. I was going to give a little quick mention, because it's not necessarily horror, but it's kind of one of those little indie efforts that somebody.
I bet it's the same as mine.
Blood on Her Name?
Yep.
Okay.
Wait, what?
Because I watched it a few days ago, and then I saw it pop up on your letterbox. I didn't see what you don't rate them, right? So
no.
It's horror in the same way like a Blue Ruin.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like a slightly smaller version of Blue Ruin. Yeah.
Noirish, kind of like almost early Coen Brothers-esque.
Yeah. Nice.
Without the humor.
Thriller. Without the humor.
There's definitely no humor. But yeah, Blue Ruin's the closest I've seen to this. It's not quite as on the directorial ability of Blue Ruin, I would say.
No.
You know,
no.
That's no, where you
but
see
very, but very good entry into to feature film by Matthew Pope.
Yeah, it just opens with a woman in trouble in a mechanic store that is hers, and she is standing over a body, and you don't know how the body's bleeding out, and you don't know how it happened, and she's looking for someone in the back, and you don't know who it is, and the person's gone, and you piece together the next day the person she was looking for was her son, and you don't know how much her son solved what happened, and you don't know the scenario, and you don't know how the person got to be dead necessarily, but the ramifications of basically a body disposal movie, which is basically at the start her going, I have to hide this body. Yeah. What do I do? And you're just in it, and you're throwing, I guess, as they say, in media res, like you're just boom, and you're in that moment with the character and making decisions, bad, poor decisions with her. And then her dad, I won't go too much in story because it's pretty minimal, but her
just
dad,
Will Patton.
Will Patton, who's just a great actor and appears in a lot of indie stuff now, turns out to be the town sheriff, and they have a kind of a fractured history. And there's just a lot of interesting threads. I liked where it went, and I just thought the performances were good and grounded.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not like so much for a show like this, but I think
it hits a little bit of a lull and then before it kind of upswings.
And it's probably only, what, like 80 minutes?
Really. Very short film. Yeah. I mean, like, it was just the kind of – I just love the urgency of like getting thrown into that situation from the get-go and then just seeing what happens to this woman. Yeah. And it's interesting because you go through many kind of emotional peaks and valleys with her, because on one hand you kind of feel for her plight and what's going on, and then you start to learn things about her past or what her situation is. Yeah. And so it's a little bit of a roller coaster, because you don't know whether to root for her or kind of go, well, you got what you deserve, you know?
Which is classic noir. Like in noir, the characters have different shading.
Exactly, exactly.
But if you like Blue Ruin, you would definitely enjoy watching this. So I do think – no, I was going to talk about it last week, and we didn't do the show last week. So it was nice that you
– it popped up on my radar, because I guess the day it had hit streaming or whatever, I saw – a lot of people talking about it, and had a pretty good Rotten Tomatoes score. Yeah. Not that I care about that, but generally when something hits like 98 or 100% sustains that, I'm like, I should probably take a look and see what this is all about.
That sounds cool.
No, it's good. I think actually it did remind me of something that you were interested at one point, so it might be worth you looking at, like in terms of that kind of world, because it also feels what's the woman's name who's directing Candyman, the new Candyman?
Oh, yes.
Nia.
Yes.
Anyway, it reminded me a little bit of her film too as well, Little Woods, which is another kind of, you know, these kind of like a rural set.
What was
crime
the name of
films.
It?
This one's
time?
Called Blood on Her Name.
Nia DaCosta. Yeah, I don't want to remember her and give her a shout out, because the Candyman trailer has debuted. I don't know if you guys talked about it last week.
No,
or the
we
week
didn't
before,
have a show last week.
But holy fucking shit, that trailer is
great.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I cannot
it looked
wait.
Like a universe expanding versus.
Yes.
No, I wasn't going to watch it until I started in theaters.
Yeah.
I'm like, yep.
Yeah.
Totally in on that one.
Yeah.
Wait, did you go for it?
Yeah, so I'm not going to talk too much about this one, because I know I'm going to discuss it on Nightmare U as well. But at Elric's recommendation, he'd been trying.
You're not allowed to talk about these ones.
I can talk about them here too. Okay. He'd been trying to get me to watch this one for a long time, and this is 1982's The Fan.
Der Fan.
It's insane.
You got that in your bag too?
I think I already returned that one to you,
I can bring it to you.
Yeah. It is fucking bonkers. Yeah, this is a Mondo release, which I will be buying my own copy of, because I enjoyed it so much, although I can't say it's one of those that you enjoy. It's more
It's bleak.
It's bleak.
It's not necromantic bleak, but it brushes up to that kind of...
It does.
It's fan obsession stuff.
Yeah, it's very... I did not picture where it was going or imagine that to quite the degree that it goes there. So yeah, it was definitely a fun view.
I refuse to talk on here with you about it because you're meant to talk somewhere else on it. So
I am.
So I'm taking a vow of silence.
I'm just going to recommend it to everybody. I'll say that the setup is that there is a young high school girl who's very withdrawn from everyone else, including her parents, because she is completely obsessed with a rock star. She writes him letters, determined that he is reading them and has fallen madly in love with her because of them. And so she's kind of created this fictionalized relationship between the two of them through these letters. You find out that like he gets millions of letters, so you know who the fuck knows what happened to him. But she has built this fictional relationship and runs away to go find him. And I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and this is one that I discovered through Kayla's book, House of Psychotic Woman. So obviously, you know, being with the possession love, that has a lot of movies like that with unhinged female characters through history of film. And that one I didn't know about really. I knew things like Christiane F. and it was kind of part of that, but this was a lot more, I don't want to say playful, but because the music has this synthwave like Kraftwerk type.
Yeah.
I think the guy who's the lead in it is actually the lead in a band that's like that for real.
Yeah, it's very much like Germany synthwave 1980s. Yeah.
It's a really cool movie, but very dark and bleak. So be prepared for a good time. But when I saw that, I really loved, and it's a Scream Factory, and I think you might have all seen it, but I never had. I borrowed Dick's copy. We're doing a something down the track for Pure Cinema. Death Valley?
Oh, yeah.
I had never seen this.
That's cool.
It is a kid from Christmas Story.
Slasher film. Yes, but the kid from Christmas
Story. I've never seen it.
Dude, yeah. I think you'll love it because the killer, or the kind of slasher character, it's not really a secret because it's revealed really quickly, is Pontypool.
Stephen
McCaddy. Very young Stephen McCaddy. And he's really good looking and like he's really attractive. And it opens, what I love about it, it's a road movie, which I already am in.
Oh, yeah, this box cover was like
it's
sacred.
This is a bit of a gem, I think, of their kind of lesser known Scream Factory titles. It opens basically the kid from Christmas Story is having his like.
Look at Stephen McCaddy.
He's in New York with the guy from Lost Boys. Aww. Who's the dad in Lost Boys?
He is good looking.
I'm pretty sure it's
the dad from Lost Boys.
Yes, I'm pretty sure it's the dad from Lost Boys.
There is no dad in Lost Boys.
The guy who's
the
like,
granddad.
Not the granddad. The guy who's becoming the dad, like the father.
Max.
So basically, it's him and the kid walking around New York like little. They're so cute because he looks like a little version of the big one, and they're spending all this time together. You're like, oh, this is gonna be a buddy film, and then he walks into the door and goes, "See you, buddy," and he's like, "Well, I see you again." He's like, "Well, you know, your mom and me, we don't see eye to eye," and he basically says goodbye to his son and like walks off, and then the sun goes up and then cuts to leaving New York. They are in fucking, you know, Arizona, and his mom is basically meeting her new boyfriend and the son is meeting him for the first time, and the whole thing is they're going to take a road trip to get used to like this new life they have. And so he's very defensive against the new father figure who's kind of a cowboy type, and I can't remember the actress who plays the mom, but she's in
a hat and neckerchief,
who's so good. Yeah,
she's Catherine Hicks from Charles.
Catherine Hicks, and she's fantastic always, and just super attractive lady. And basically, they start going on this road trip, and while they're going on the road trip, you are seeing somebody in this cool car, kind of Jeepers Creepers style, is creeping up behind them, and the kid notices the car for some reason, and then that car is seen on a murder site that happens. It's a good slasher scene coming up, and then they all check into a hotel, and we find out that McCaddy's also at that hotel, and then there's some twists to still be had, and you know, you really, it's a kid in peril. It's like a perfect Kinder Trauma movie, because not only is it Kinder Trauma, where the kid's in danger,
right,
but it's also about parental divorce and the new boyfriend, and so it's like all those things that make for that kind of entertainment. So I think it was great. Like, I really dug this one. Highly recommend Death Valley. I don't know if it's still in print, but
it might be. It was one of their very first releases. That's why I remember it being like part of the initial 10.
Yeah, I just had never
that's right
it.
Yeah, that was early on,
super early. Yeah.
For some strange reason.
I also rewatched Freeway, so I was doing a couple road movies.
Oh my gosh.
Hadn't seen that since it came out. It's really good.
I love Freeway.
It holds
Freeway
up
so
really
much.
Well. I can see why it's not everyone's cup of tea, though, because kind of humor is so in your face.
It is.
But it's great. And it's such a, like, people make films about, like, you know, molesters and rapists and that stuff, but they do it with the way they do it with Kiefer in this and make him just so grotesque and monstrous by the end.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious.
They
it's,
both function as exploitation films. Yeah. I mean, the second one more so than the first one.
I still haven't seen the second.
The second one explodes.
Because Vincent Gallo is in it, I will watch it.
But, yeah, the second one, whereas this one, you know, I dare say, the grotesqueness and the exploitation and kind of the over-the-top, like, holy shit, I can't believe I'm watching this, is somewhat subtle compared to the second one, where it is just like, my God, what? It's just crazy.
Freeway might be one of the least subtle films I've ever seen. So what
and
you're telling me
you
is kind of like, what?
Two. It's Vincent Gallo as a nun.
Okay, I've heard that.
And there's a lot of other, there's
but
cannibalism,
they say trick baby
molestation,
in
there's
she goes,
bulimia.
I'm not your trick baby. And I was like, ooh, what's a trick
it's
baby?
It's a good name, right?
So I drove downtown and asked around.
I heard there's a
fancy, for $25, you can find out.
You can find a trick baby.
A trick baby.
I heard that there is a Fancy Schmanz Blu-ray of Freeway that I have not purchased yet that I should probably get some.
But also, I forgot how good Reese bursts on the scene with this performance that is unreal. Like, it's such a confident, bold performance, such big choices.
Like, it's not a good character. I mean, like, for.
No, but it's great.
It feels like, very, like, she's playing, like, this illiterate.
Yeah, she's
like,
illiterate.
She's illiterate, teenage, kind of. I don't want to call.
There's one scene that's uncomfortable because she says some really racist things to the black police officer, but because her boyfriend is at the start is who is her boyfriend? The guy who's amazing in season 2 of Fargo. Her boyfriend is a black guy, so it kind of comes around. You realize it wasn't actually her being racist; she was just trying to mess with the cop. But there was a moment where I was watching in the middle, and I don't usually get offended by, you know, old movies where you can't really change things. But I was even going, "Oh shit, this just aged this movie." But then it comes around, and you kind of understand why. But it's a great, you know, it's one of the best versions of an old fairy tale.
Yeah,
it's
like, and Kiefer with the neck brace
hilarious.
And everything. It's so horrifying and grotesque, and that's I think what makes this movie so good. Is that Kiefer, I mean, you're watching it the whole time going, I can't believe I'm watching this, but it is one of those like good bonkers movies. Yeah. But the fact that Kiefer and Reese just go, they fucking go for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it is, they throw themselves into this absolutely outlandish, batshit crazy performance.
I'm bummed that Matthew Bright hasn't done more things that are worth us checking down. Like he did Tiptoes, which is a little weird. And I don't know. He's just one of those people. It's like, I see the voice here. And I guess he was a good friend of the Elfmans. I think he was a childhood friend because Danny does the score to this, which is a great score.
Oh, yeah.
Very playful score. And this guy wrote Forbidden Zone with the other Richard Elfman.
Richard, yeah.
Oh.
I read something saying they're all childhood or teenage friends.
And he did Ted Bundy movie too.
Oh, okay.
He did the one that Tiffany Shepis is in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I own Trick Baby. Weird. Remind me to
I want
to
watch it. Well, it might be. I think they're both streaming on Amazon. I saw this on Amazon. I think number two was too.
Oh,
so
excellent.
I need
definitely.
To see it. Yeah.
So number two, I happened on, this was one of those.
You told us about it. That's why it came into my brain. I remember you talking about both of them.
It was how I first found the first one was back in college in the 90s, I had Cinemax. And Cinemax was fantastic for like, I don't even know what the fuck I'm watching movies late at night. Usually they just turned out to be like porn. But I found a lot of just kind of batshit crazy movies that way. But I remembered turning it on one night on a weekend at like 2 a.m. and it was just Vincent Gallo in dressed as the nun, and I watched the tail end of it, and then I suddenly was like, what was this? I have to see the whole thing. And so I ended up seeing two before I saw one.
Weird.
But yeah, two's bonkers.
Could someone say Trick Baby one more time?
Trick Baby. $25.
Oh God. Did everyone finish The Outsider on HBO? Oh,
I have one episode to go. I can stick my fingers in my ears
behind,
and hum.
There's nothing to spoil. Yeah.
Except that it ends great and it's still strong.
I was very satisfied with the entire thing. I thought it was a really good adaptation. I liked the – I don't remember. I didn't pick up the deviations too much because it's been a little bit since I read the book.
I hadn't read it, but I looked it up afterwards.
Yeah, it wasn't stuff that like totally threw me off in any way. I thought they held the course, and I really
– It's one of the best King adaptations
overall. I think landed it.
Yeah. She's now my favorite actress.
She's great.
Yes, so good.
And he's great. I mean – Again, I've been saying for years, get Ben in normal roles, not just playing bad guys.
Yeah.
He's so wasted. And I mean, it's cool that he gets the Star Wars money and things and Batman money, but he's so much more than that. I saw him on so many TV shows in Australia, and if you want to see a great Animal Kingdom, it's one of the before it was a TV show in America, it is one of the best film debuts I've ever seen. It's like The Godfather, and it's an Australian crime movie, and he is amazing. He's like the unhinged brother who's off his meds and returns to this crime family, and he's one of the most dangerous characters I've ever seen in a movie. Like, it's a great crime film.
Yeah.
And Joel Edgerton's in that too.
Yeah. Well, it was great. I liked it.
Yep.
Yeah. I need to get my internet set up at the house.
Stop moving.
You're behind on everything.
You don't
I'm behind internet? No.
How are you alive?
I don't know. You know, it's okay though. I did watch Sabrina season 3 episode 1 and I'm digging it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
They're up to season 3 of that?
I know. It's just impossible to keep track of
streaming
all
shows
the stuff that Netflix just...
I think I watched 2 episodes.
Yeah, we're watching Outsider, Sabrina, Picard. Those are like the 3 we're zeroing
How's
in on.
Picard?
Everything else. Picard is good. Hmm. I have immense joy watching Ciara watch it because she gets tears in her eyes whenever there's like some like iconic moment. And she's like, oh, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's how you felt when I was watching Force Awakens. But, you know, it's, I don't know where it's going. I kind of appreciate like them roping Borg stuff back into the picture. How can you not when there's Picard there? But I don't know. I wish the writing was a little bit better. Mm. Kind of wish it was a little bit better. But it's just fun seeing Patrick Stewart doing his thing. And we haven't gotten nearly as deep into it as what's out there. So we haven't seen a lot of the big cameos. But Seven of Nine just showed up and we're like, whoa. So Jerry Ryan, yo.
Yeah. Cool.
Oh, Becca, that's right. You haven't. Have you watched any of this?
I have not watched it yet. Who's playing 709?
709?
709.
Jerry Ryan.
Oh, that's awesome.
Everybody's back.
Oh, my gosh.
Everybody's back. Yeah,
that
is
crazy. Oh,
wait,
I have not
Next
watched
Next Generation before. Cast is back?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I knew Fraker, maybe.
Jonathan Frakes. Yeah.
A lot of Frake. Them. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, everybody came back. It's great.
That's fantastic. Okay, yeah.
No, nobody's Data. Looking at me overlooking my Data's computer. Dead. No, I'm waiting for...
He did die.
Oh, Max Van Sydow. Yeah, I watched The Seventh Seal in honor of Max.
Let's talk about Max Van Sydow.
Nice.
Because when I tweeted the video of him getting makeup put on him, I think people's brains still get blown by the fact that he was 43 years old
when he was in The X.
When he was in The X, and he looks so young when you see the makeup being put on him.
Which I had a discussion because as soon as that happened, my mom, I was on the phone with her when it came on the news, and she was like, "He was like 80 in the 70s," and I was like, "No." No, I don't think he was.
It really hurt his career doing The Exorcist. Yeah. And, I mean, that's how good Dick Smith's makeup was. Yeah. But, tremendous actor. And I had that Bergman box set that I've been meaning to break open and hearing him pass. I was like, well, there's no better movie than The Seventh Seal to really, you know.
Yeah, there's horror elements to that. The Virgin Springs, obviously, the original Last House on the Left. Yeah. And for me, like one of my favorite horror films of all time is Hour of the Wolf. It's one of the most atmospheric, darkest, nightmare-fueled movies you will ever see. One of the biggest influences on Lynch.
Hour of the Wolf.
If you look at Lost
Highway
and Hour of the Wolf, it's like the same fucking
imagery in it is just insane.
No, and it's scary and dark. And so, like, you know, so he did some, he went there with Bergman.
I've been on this kind of Exorcist kick revisiting the entire franchise. And I watched the first film and then I listened to the audiobook.
Dominion?
No. I listened to the audiobook, which was read by William Peter Blatty. Ooh. And I've never read the book. I've never listened to the book. So thinking, you know, it makes for great sitting in traffic, you know, on a drive home kind of entertainment. But the differences are kind of interesting because there's a lot of stuff that Friedkin and Blatty chose to leave out of the film that I am just like absolutely fascinated by. I want to know more. It's interesting because in the book, Father Karras goes on a little bit of a more of a procedural journey as he, you know, meets Reagan and then kind of go off on this tangent where he's hitting the books and reading about exorcisms and looking at other cases and all. It's all super fascinating. And Kinderman, who's the detective, you know, he's going on this journey of the belief system that maybe Reagan fucking killed Burke Dennings, the director, because like it's alluded to a little bit in the movie. Yeah. You know, it's hinted at, but they really lean into it in the book, where even Chris McNeil has some sort of suspicion that maybe her daughter did it.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's really, really interesting. But by the final pages and the very much like the final minutes of the movie, it still gets me. I'm not religious by any means, but it still gets me when Karras is laying at the bottom of the steps, bleeding out, and Father Dyer comes up and he's like, "Hey, you have any other confessions, Father?" I get welled up with emotion. Mm-hmm. It's just like, oh my God. It works so well. The power of that movie, it just holds up.
Yeah, it's great.
So well.
One of the best celebrity conversations I've had since living in LA was pretty early. I think I was doing one of those Inside Horror things, and it was at one of those conventions I got to talk to Tippi Hedren. Mm. And a story I didn't know, which I just love this story. She was telling me she was her husband was a book literature agent or whatever. And one of their close friends was Blatty. And her husband didn't have the time to read it. She got to read Exorcist chapter by chapter as it was done. So as each chapter, she was the first person in the world probably to read it. And she was fucking terrified. She was the one who was selling it to her husband by the end.
Yeah.
And then they end up, it was just such a cool way to imagine that story unfolding chapter by chapter. I'm like,
so
I love that.
Wild. child.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, now I finished the book and I'm like, honey, it's on to Exorcist 2. Let's do this.
Oh, boy.
So we started it last night.
Oh, geez.
And it was a perfect night because it was really rainy outside and kind of moody. And I was like, I'm ready. I have not seen it in years. And we basically got up to, I am Pazuzu. And then I was like,
oh boy.
Okay, you know what? It's time for bed. I'm going to revisit this when
even
I'm a little bit more awake.
Just the opening of her standing on like the rooftop. Yeah. It's like, what is going on, nighty? You're like,
No. There's a moment where they're doing this hypnosis thing. Louise Fletcher is like strapped into this device. Linda Blair is standing behind her because Louise Fletcher has gotten caught into some hypnosis and she's like in the zone. Mm. And Richard Burnett like has to sit down. He's like, I know where she is. Put the device on my head. And he kind of gets hypnotized and goes into the zone. And they keep cutting to Louise Fletcher, who is kind of like dazed and staring off. Linda Blair is holding on to Louise Fletcher by her left boob. And she's like supposed to be, I guess, feeling for her heartbeat because her heart is palpitating. But the decision on Linda Blair's part to just like – grasp the left side of her chest, the entire scene is very awkward to watch because then they do that whole flashback to what happened to Father Marin in the room when Reagan, where Reagan is like possessed, but it's like superimposed over the frame of Louise Fletcher sitting there. So you're like in the past and present at the same time.
That shows she's thinking about it.
Yeah. But the possessed Reagan of the past is reaching her hand out, so it's touching Linda Blair in the present, her hand. So you've got two Linda Blairs grasping Louise Fletcher's boob and like massaging her heart, but it's so awkward to watch. And so, I'm like, this is a creative decision that was clearly made to superimpose it at this point. And I don't know, man. There are some very interesting choices made in this film. I cannot wait to finish it just so I can go, okay, it's fresh in my brain. This movie is terrible. Moving on to
And the greatest quote I've ever heard about a movie that I've quoted a few times recently, Quentin Tarantino on this movie. If you watch it without sound, it's actually pretty good. And when I heard that quote, I was like, oh, that is perfect.
But it is. But I will say it is weird to watch in a kind of like a really I'm very sleepy state because I fell asleep around the I Am Pazuzu part. And then I woke back up and James Earl Jones is in some sort of locust costume. Yeah. And locust, I woke up and I was like, ooh, okay.
Yeah, no, that stuff
Let's
in
see
the
what
past
happens
is
here.
Utterly bonkers. I got to watch it again too. It's such a weird movie.
But I am looking forward because when I get to Exorcist 3, I know that's great in a safe zone. By Exorcist 4, I've never seen the Paul Schrader cut. I've only seen the Rennie Harlan.
Man. Watch them both back to back. It's kind of a fascinating study to watch them both back to back and see how they were constructed, what directors made what choices, what footage from one ended up in another.
The Harlan one was so boring.
So boring.
I was so bored that I couldn't even bring myself.
Which one?
To watch
I don't even remember
one.
Which
They're
one's
both
itch.
Bad. Yeah.
There's one that has like a lot of action with the wolf giving birth. And
that's their Harlan one.
Yeah,
Harlan Schrader one's by far the Schrader one's even more boring than the Harlan one. Like at least the Harlan one, they bring the Reagan version of the Exorcist back into it.
Yeah.
Or not the Exorcist, the demon.
Yeah.
Whereas the Schrader one's really boring. Yeah. Three is great though, and the thing I love about three is whatchamacallit. The fact that it's so funny because I don't think it's in the cut that you just watched. Did you watch the theatrical cut of the original?
Yes,
My preferred one too.
That's my preferred.
But I think at Blatty's request, he went back in and put a tiny little thing at the ending. Which was because the cop is Kinderman. Kinderman is George C. Scott in that movie, and so him and the priest, the original priest that survives. And him are the best friends in Exorcist 3.
Yeah.
But like, there's nothing really that sets them up that they became buddies at all. So there's one little tag scene.
Oh, that's
of
right.
The
yes.
two of them.
Them like go. Them getting ready to go to the movies together.
And
or something
it sets
like
up that okay, now in Exorcist 3, it's been 10, 20 years, and they've been going to the movies together
that's right.
ever since.
Yes, yeah. And it's interesting too.
That's the only addition I really like.
Well, it was interesting. Yeah, I like that too. And I remember it was on the Laserdisc or something like that. But I remember the Kinderman story about the carp in the bathtub that he talks about in Exorcist 3 is actually in the Exorcist book.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Wow. So it was something that Blatty just like saved for himself later on.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And it's great because it's a great scene.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Well, momentarily, everyone's looking at the news, but momentarily.
Yeah, yeah. Some shit just broke while we were doing this, guys.
I was just looking at Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson getting it. I had just said earlier today, I said, who would be the first celebrities? Because that's when these things often get real. Yeah. When somebody and I can't think of a less deserving human. Thank you, no God on this planet. Because if Tom Hanks is getting sick, there is no God on this planet.
So Tom Hanks has corona. They just suspended the NBA season. And
which, by the way, this is 2 days ago that you're learning all this.
Yeah. So imagine how cutting it's
And I just got an email that I don't have to go back into work until
But I can't think of a worse place to be during times like these than on social media. So stay the fuck off Twitter and Facebook. Yeah. And like I see like things in the feed like we're living in end times. Shut up. You know what? You don't need to rile people up.
But
get the facts.
To be fair, Ryan, 2 days from now, they could be. So by the time you hear this, it could be. And this could be the last broadcast.
Everybody listening to this is like, so really interesting fact, Ryan. Death came riding in on a fucking pale horse from the sky. Yeah. And he knocked out your front door.
We have pestilence now. Great going.
Anything is possible. But we do pledge to you, if this isn't the last episode, we will go as long as we can.
Yeah.
And we will find some secure recording place.
We would go to Skype before anything completely.
Well, all right. So we're going to welcome our guest who hopefully showed up. And then everything. Just, yes.
Wash your hands.
Everybody be kind. Everybody,
don't touch your face.
I'm not saying be calm. I'm just saying be vigilant.
Don't touch your face.
Don't touch your face. Do not touch Elric's face.
Take care of yourself.
No more.
I don't think
I can give up this gift.
We can't buy toilet paper. My mom in Virginia, there was a news story on the Virginia News Tonight about how LA had no toilet paper left. And she was like, do you need me to send you a few rolls? And I was like, we're fine.
So. Wow. Well, Ted Geegan was like on his Facebook the other day. He's like, meanwhile, in New York. And it was just like aisles of toilet paper.
Yeah. Interesting.
Anyways, fun we times, hope everybody's guys. Okay. Take care of yourselves.
We'll be back in a moment with our guest.
For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source of horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you are looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust and Who's Not, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com. And let's make that clear. It's DiabolikDVD.com.
Severin Films presents Blood and Flesh, the real life and ghastly death of Al Adamson, now available on digital platforms, Amazon, Vudu, iTunes, Google Play, and more. The award-winning documentary from the makers of The Lost Soul, The Doomed Journey of Richard Stanley's Island of Dr. Moreau, Blood and Flesh tells the sometimes hilarious, sometimes shocking story of a B-movie maverick, Al Adamson, who was found murdered at his ranch in the desert in the mid-90s. Blood and Flesh is also available as part of the massive Al Adamson Masterpiece Collection box set, 32 movies on 14 discs with special features and exclusive new 126-page book. Classic, newly remastered Adamson films include Dracula vs. Frankenstein, Satan's Sadist, a personal favorite, Carnival Magic, Heart of the Blood Monsters, Black Samurai, The Naughty Stewardesses, and many more. The Al Adamson Masterpiece Collection from www.severin-films.com. Also available for pre-order from Severin, Kids, When the Wind Blows, the animated feature on the Blu-ray, to Scar a New Generation. Based on the graphic novel by Raymond Briggs, with music by Roger Waters and David Bowie, it's Threads for Kids. Oof, that's brutal. Los Angeles Severin fans, join us for the return of the Severin Super Shock Pop-Up Film Festival on March 28th at the Montalban Theater in Hollywood. Sneak previews of forthcoming titles on the big screen, future release trailers and short film teaser, exclusive gift bags, and more. Tickets available at eventbrite.com.
Tonight's show is also brought to you by Wellgo Entertainment. From the writer and director of I Saw the Devil comes the film with bone-crunching, blood-spurting action, says Birth Movies Death. The Witch Subversion is a serious revenge thriller with kick-ass bloody action. Now available on digital, Blu-ray, and DVD. Again, that is The Witch Subversion from Wellgo Entertainment. Tonight's episode is also brought to you by Fangoria. It's 2020, and Fangoria magazine is back on the shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from all the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and much, much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. Use promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now. Again, that's promo code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off.
Welcome back to the show. I'm very excited. This is a guest I've been trying to get on for a while because I don't think we've had a lot of editors. We had trailer editors on.
We had Garrow on.
We had Garrow on.
Mark Goldblatt.
Goldblatt,
but he's also a director, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had people who do both, like Flanagan and people like that who like direct and edit. But yeah.
None of those people edited Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
This is true.
But no movie guest, I'd rather talk about.
Amy Duddleton's here. Hi. Welcome.
Hi, you guys. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for coming in.
And actually, that's where we met on we're both good friends with Scott Reynolds, who's writer-producer on Dexter, and you were an editor on the last 2 seasons of that.
Yes.
And so I remember very distinctly him saying, hey, you need to meet our editor on Dexter, Amy, because she did Psycho. And I'm like, wait, what? I have so many questions. And we saved them all for the last time I saw you, which is when we got together at my place to do the commentary for the Scream Factory Blu-ray.
So much fun.
It was fun. And within 5 minutes, you're like, here's where it all went kind of wrong. Which was amazing. But yeah, I mean, not that we need an excuse to bring you in, but you edited several of the episodes of Hunters, which is now on Amazon.
Correct.
And I just
like has editing. Like, there's a lot going on
there's
in that. It's like a layered genre, every kind of genre you can imagine. It's interesting.
I was not expecting it to be what it is. Yeah. And it's fascinating, and I'm enjoying it deeply. Yeah.
Yes.
And so let's start there with Hunters, and we can go backwards a little bit. But that project, so when a TV project like that comes to you, and in particular, I mean, you know, Jordan Peele's producing, Al Pacino's the star. We got Nazi Hunters. It feels kind of like a recipe for just a lot of cool stuff. And then I was pretty surprised. The first episode's a different story because that's like its own one-off feature.
Yes.
So how did you respond to the material when you first came in on it? Like, what did they tell you? And did you know how crazy this tone was going to be?
I had no – I mean, I knew it was going to be crazy from the script, the first script for the pilot, because, you know, it starts off with that crazy scene with Dylan Baker. And,
that's great.
Yeah. And – but what really grabbed me was when they get Gretel in the shower, and you're not sure if she's like old Jewish lady or Nazi. And so for me, I was just like, whoa. That just blew my mind. And then the barbecue from the beginning, I was just like, oh my God,
that's
is
a pretty
insane.
Strong. Yeah.
And then it just kept going. And then you meet Meyer and he brings in, you know, and he's trying to reel in Jonah and the whole thing. I was dying. I just loved it. Yeah. And so when I had my interview, which was on Skype, it was hard too because I was like, it was so great. And I know I'm like this big.
I think we're going to feel more of those happening.
Apparently, next couple of weeks.
Yeah. We're all going to have some Skype stories.
Hey, how about that Skype? Just trying to convey like how much I loved it. You know, it was nice. Just like, you know, when you get offered a show like, and Pacino's going to play this part and Jordan Peele's the, you know, you think, oh, well, I just want to do it. But then you read it and then you really want to do it. And then you really want the job. So I was excited when I got it and I was really happy. And so then when I got the script for my episode, I was like, this is completely off the rails. Like, I had no idea.
Which was the first one you did?
Episode 2.
Okay. Which kind of introduces everybody.
Introduces, you know, it's like Jonah and the Hunters, and you want to be a part of this? Well, here you go.
Yeah. And it has kind of a comic book feel, too. Obviously, echoing that they work in comic book stores and making a whole pulp thing about, kind of like the way Inglourious Basterds does a bit.
Yes, with the little poster.
It feels very much like it's based on a graphic novel that mm-hmm. doesn't exist.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of weird. But, you know, well, tell us a little bit about the process because I don't really know when it comes to shows. So you get hired, but you're one of a few editors that's on the show.
Yeah.
And then so how do they divvy up episodes between editors? Like how is it kind of worked out?
Well, there was one who worked on the pilot and then it kind of just goes like every – you know, there are three of us, so it's every other – you know, it just goes in threes. Mm-hmm. So I ended up with 2 and 5. But then I got moved to episode 9 because episode 8 was – I was supposed to do episode 8 and it was starting to pile up. And then the other editor who didn't have as much going on took it out, you know, so it was great. So.
The listeners can skip the episodes in between. 2, 5, 9. Boom,
well,
out.
Edited in the bunch.
I want to jump back to like the beginning. You have some – crazy industry creds before you even started editing. Yeah. Like, Can't Buy Me Love.
Oh, wow.
Well, you know, I was a PA.
That doesn't matter. You were on the set for Can't Buy Me Love.
I was.
That's amazing.
That's so, awesome.
Go back to the very beginning. What was your first interest in film? I mean, did you want to direct? Did you want to write?
I always wanted to be an editor.
Editor.
Oh, my gosh. What?
I know.
Okay, so
it's crazy.
I teach at USC. I have students, and they all come in wanting to be directors. And then by the second year, some of them want to be editors, which I am always kind of shocked by because when I look at editing, it's the one area of film production that I look at and go, I don't know how you do that. Because it's literally like you are putting together a puzzle that someone else has painted that you kind of have a vague understanding of what the picture might look like, and it's a million pieces, but you only get 1,000 of them go.
And there's this kind of set of instructions called the script.
Yeah, kind of, but even that's really fluid by that point, because we have that saying in Hollywood, there's three versions of every film, the one that's written, the one that's shot, and the one that's edited.
Yep.
So it completely changes at that point as well. So, yeah, why editing?
When I was like 17, I read an article about the editor D.D. Allen in the New York Times magazine or whatever. I was doing research for some paper in English, and I came across this article just like randomly, and I just started reading it, and I was like, you know, I saw a picture of this woman and she had film in her hands, and I thought, wow, well, it looks interesting, a woman holding onto film. And then I read it and I was just like, this sounds like the most interesting job in the world. I want to do that.
Were you already a movie kid?
I was a movie kid. Yeah. I loved movies. Yeah. And
what kind? What was the entry point for you? What kind of?
Oh, gosh.
Anything scar you or?
Well, yeah, you know, The Exorcist scarred
me. We just got done talking about that.
Yeah. On topic.
Ruined my life.
What age? I always am curious. What age? Do you remember how old?
I remember. I was a teenager. My parents protected me pretty well from, like, scary things. What was, like, the first movie that got me? That I just remember, like, the power of movies. I remember seeing Raging Bull, like being, like, 15 or, like, whenever that came out. And
I was imagining you at 8 watching Raging Bull. Yeah, what? Really? Okay.
I was a teenager. Yeah. But
great editor, that film, obviously. It's one of the great edited films.
No, but I just remember, like, realizing there's so much going on and, you know, there's just more to movies than story and like actors, and I just realized that there was something else going on there and I didn't know what it was, and then I read the story about D.D. Allen a couple of years later and I was like, that's what that is, it's editing. So
how do you turn that into getting to do it though, because obviously a lot of us shot like VHS films or whatever.
Absolutely.
How did you make that segue? Was it film school?
I went to university. They didn't really have a film major, but they had film classes. And they were starting to develop a little bit of film. So I went into that. It was basically fine art. You know, you had to study everything. You had to study theater and, you know, film and radio and music. But you had to take art classes too. So it was a pretty great education, I have to say. But when I got out of school, I was still very determined. But I got a job as a driver on Can't Buy Me Love because they shot it in Tucson, Arizona, where I went to school, and that was how I worked on Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah. That was my first question.
Was that shot in Tucson as well?
Yes, it was, on the U of A campus. Wow. And that was how I got a job in the editing room. And that was...
Were you on the set?
I was in the editing room. They had the editing room in town, and we showed dailies every night to the cast. And
make a move. I can sing that shit.
So could I, yeah.
So that was, and so that, I just seeing how it all worked in an editing room, that was it. I was like hooked.
Do you ever get as mad as I do about the Oscars when they give editing awards to for movies that are clearly story structure? Like, clearly it was the script that was structured that way. But that I always laugh because I'm like, who's deciding these?
Who's deciding this?
Because of, that Kathy Bates documentary, the thing they say is in the kind of industry period of Hollywood where they said, well, women were editors because it was seen to be like knitting and it was an assembly job they could do with their hands.
Holy shit.
And I'm listening to that going, that's so funny. But I mean, at least they're getting something, right? But when you think about it now, it's one of the most complex parts of filmmaking, and it takes the most kind of vision.
But it is true. It's just like, I saw this picture of Dee Dee Allen, and I saw, this is a woman who works in the film industry. That's a job I can do. Mm-hmm. You know,
that because was like there was another a role model to look at. Yeah.
You know, there's a picture of her holding film in her hands, you know, so...
Which led directly to Stepfather 2. I don't believe in segues. So Terry O'Quinn hired you. Tell me about
Terry O'Quinn. No, I was friends with the Burr brothers, Jeff.
Oh, Jeff.
Yeah.
Who's been on the show?
Jeff Burr. Mm-hmm. So his parents were friends with my parents growing up.
Wow.
Isn't that funny? Yeah. And so that actually happened like right when I moved to Los Angeles. Oh. And they were working on that. And, you know, my dad called his dad.
Oh, wow.
And I got a job. And they, like, paid me out of their pocket. And it just kind of led to other things.
But you're editing on film, obviously.
Oh, yes.
At the start of your career. So, obviously, that's, like, radically different now in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I think in Walter Murcher, somebody mentioned one of the big differences is you used to know the material so well because you had to go through it all to go find it. And now you can just cut to where you want to go. So you don't editors maybe don't aren't as familiar
you
with
you aren't watching the dailies as much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I find that interesting.
It's a sad fact.
Do you miss the physical side of editing on film at all? Or is it was
I
it
don't
just really
miss
hard?
How slow it was.
Of course,
That was the hardest part. I mean, I do miss some of the physicality of it, but I do love just having it all there.
And
being able to just
click a button instead of snipping.
You know, 12 versions in, you know, 10 minutes where I can just change something and go back and it was very hard to do that.
Even when you're seeing people, I did a little bit towards the end, but seeing the marks and going, oh my God. Like,
splices.
And when you see optical effects, you're like, how the hell did they do all this? Like
In our brains.
I remember that day in college where, and this is at the tail end where everything was shifting over to digital, but they would wheel out the steam back and rip the tarp off and be like, okay, we're cutting on this today, guys. And all we did was like a couple of cuts and it took the entire class.
It goes really fast. It's like 16 millimeter goes and
but I guess the big thing that leads us to Psycho that I think is really exciting is you've worked multiple times with one of the most interesting directors I think, which is a huge To Die Fan,
To Die For.
I think that's
amazing.
One of those great American movies. Even Cowgirls Get the Blues is really fun. So how did you meet Gus and what was like, how did that relationship start?
Well, I met the editor of Drugstore Cowboy, Curtis Clayton, and he was working on this film that needed another assistant like badly. And so I came in and, you know, worked and helped them get their editing room in shape. And it was a great experience for me because I had just been like an apprentice and been given like menial tasks. And I knew how to do all these other things, but I hadn't had the opportunity to do them. So I was able to come into this cutting room and like really impress him. And he was like, well, I have this movie coming up and you'd have to move to Portland, Oregon for 6 months. But, you know, it's Gus Van Sant's next movie. And I was like, yes.
And it's a really good one.
I have no idea who's it, you know, and then you find out it's River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves.
It was my own
Private Idaho. So
before Joy Street.
Yeah. But that was how I got to meet Gus. And so that, you know, just working with Curtis and I became a team. And then...
Well, and obviously, like working with a director, it's like I remember on that same documentary, I think it's Ridley Scott talks about it being, it's like a marriage. You need to make sure it's going to be a good one or it's going to be a bad one. And then he talks about like bad editing. So what was it about working, you know, with these opportunities to kind of get to know him? What was that working relationship? What clicked? Is he a fairly intuitive filmmaker?
Oh, he's super intuitive. Yeah. And he just like goes at everything like it's a painting. You know, you just keep adding or subtracting things, and that's the way he works. Yeah. You know, everything's kind of like a weird poem.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, too many words.
And sometimes they're not even his poems.
No.
Sometimes they're very classical poems.
They're very classical poems.
But you just kind of trace the poem.
but you lobbied for the editing gig for Psycho when you
When I found out he was doing it, I had just edited this movie High Art. Mm-hmm. And that was like my first like big
Ally
editing
credit.
Yeah, a movie that actually went to Sundance and had a release. And so I gave Gus a copy of it because I knew he was going to do this movie. And I knew that because of what he was going to be trying to do, that maybe I had a really good chance, you know, like – we're just going to be like putting it together frame, you know, like I didn't have to, you know, he didn't need a big name editor to like do this little shot by shot, you know, remake of Psycho. And I just, you know, like everything in this business, you just have to put yourself out there.
Did Psycho mean something to you?
It was a film that I loved.
Yeah, obviously.
And
most people don't.
Gus had talked about it like through the years of like, if you're going to remake a movie, just remake it. Just shot by shot, just remake it. And so we would always just laugh and laugh. Yeah. And so after he did Good Will Hunting, they were like, how much money do you want?
Yeah, yeah.
So he was like, I want to do Psycho and I want, you know, $20 million or whatever it was. And here you go. Conceptual art piece, you know.
And Christopher Doyle shooting it, which is like wild because he's Wong Kar-wai is amazing DP. And
it was insane.
But it's obviously it's a pure art thing. I think at the time I wasn't seeing it through. I was just going to the movies to go. Yeah. What did they do to what is it going to be? But like it's over the years you start thinking about it in that more abstract way. It's like this is some crazy experiment.
Yeah. Truly. You know?
Well, were you editing while they were shooting?
Yeah.
So was there a point? Because again, I don't remember exactly how we talked about it on the commentary. But the assignment. All right, we're going to do it shot for shot. This and that. But at what point do you realize, okay, so pacing in 1960
the shower
is
scene.
Really different
really
in 98.
Really threw us. The shower scene.
So was it pretty early on that you realized maybe this doesn't work because of the pacing? Because that's
some
you
of
know,
it was that.
Yeah.
It was like modern people that it just stopped. It working.
Didn't feel well. Now, and Gus did. I mean, was there other stuff? I mean, famously, the clouds. There's clouds in every Gus Van Sant movie. That's like his jam is clouds.
Yeah.
So the clouds in this, was there other stuff that he put in that was like 100% like a left turn from the original of like, you know, we're going to.
Just like the cow, the bondage thing. I mean, I think that Nine Inch Nails video had just come out. And so we were like.
but I am curious about the inspiration for that because if you're. Well, if you're trying to do shot by shot.
Well, because correct me if I'm wrong, but you cut the shower scene exactly as
absolutely.
Is, and then you guys watched it and it didn't work. And then didn't you mention the trailer? Because they'd cut a great trailer.
Yeah, we saw the trailer and we were like, what about those things they put in the trailer?
I love that it's influencing it. That's great.
Like who knows who cut that trailer, but they put all that imagery in the trailer.
They put all this weird imagery.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
That was like, you know, obviously the Nine Inch Nails video. Yeah. And
I saw that there was a Russian director on the making of. I remember just from years ago. I always show the not to spoil it, every class. I've never taught a film class where I haven't shown the original Psycho and the shower scene to just talk about the inability to not, as an artist, sign your work. And I can't remember the Russian director, but he's in the making of, and he goes, you know, when somebody does a forgery, they don't sign their own thing. But Gus can't help himself. He has to sign
Gus Van Sant.
Especially with, to me, it was like the bondage thing and when William H. Macy's murdered.
Yes.
Which is also
Arbogast, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great scene too. And by the end, there's just these images that make you do feel like, oh, well, that part feels like an original film. And if anything, might be the signal that the thing doesn't work because maybe if you'd gone all the way into that and he had made the Gus Van Sant version of Psycho, maybe you'd have a very different thing. You know, who knows what that would look
like?
Yeah, especially because he probably cast it right.
Gus Van Sant. Yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah,
you know?
Just his own interp of it.
Were there other scenes that totally, like, I just haven't seen it recently, but like that do work despite the pacing? And because obviously suspense should be paced like that at times.
Oh, obviously. No, like anytime Marion was driving the car, it was perfect.
Yeah, super cool.
It was perfect.
Yeah, with that music.
And like the sound of the voice in the back, and you know, and she's like, I wonder if she really worked on this, like, you know,
the frantic face,
the frantic face, and having the sound in your head. And like, she was really good, Anne Heche. Yeah. That was perfect. Yeah. It's like it matches right up. It's amazing.
What about Robert Forster comes in at the end to give that wonderful speech? So was it? I heard he did it like 50 something times, or
it was so many times. And
and why was that? He wasn't matching the pacing of the original.
Well, it's so just wrong in so many ways. I mean, in the original and. Having it now, it just did not.
Because it's such early psycho babble back then. It made sense, but now it's like okay, we've seen enough.
Transvestite people.
You're like, his mind is splintered. And,
No, we cut so much of it out. And yeah, he did a million takes because it was just, you know.
Wow.
The biggest one, though, the biggest difference, and I take umbrage in this in the more of a psychological sense that I find fascinating, is in this when Perkins looks through the viewfinder, it actually shows him masturbate. Yeah. And my feeling, the only reason it's kind of edgy, and I think I see why they did, but I think I talked to you about this once, and I was like, here's the problem. The reason I think Anthony Perkins stabs him is because he doesn't get off.
He has to be impressed. Mom would never allow that.
But when Vince Vaughn's getting off, I remember being in the moment going, wait a minute. I don't understand. What is this?
If he's like, doing it threw this, me in why a, does he need to kill people?
Yeah, why is he, you know? Right? So, but that was a major addition. Like, it's subtle because you're just, you know, you maybe forget what the original is, but there's a few little things in there that are quite different. And so it's always interesting on the artist point.
We
like, why
I put
that
in there. And I remember going, well, I don't know, you know, and Gus was like, let's just screen it for them and see what they think. And like Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, you know, they were the producers and they liked it. They were like,
they're like, I like that Vince Vaughn.
You know, Vaughn masturbating.
Keep it.
Well, I'm curious.
Make it longer.
Did the studio wind up previewing it at all?
Oh, like, no, we never previewed it.
I was going to say, how do you even go through a process with a movie like that?
It was impossible.
Interesting.
And how did you guys get away with that? Was there just this fixed release date? Because I feel like almost like, Gus did Good Will Hunting. And they're like, what do you want to do? He's like, give me $20 million to make Psycho. And I'm going to do it shot for shot. And then before you know it, it's out.
It's there.
Seriously.
It was like, you know, I was editing while they were shooting. It was a very fast process. We did it pretty quickly, like 5 months, you know. For a film, that's...
Yeah, but is that, like, having to do the shot-by-shot and time it, does that make your job, obviously, kind of more restricted? Is that frustrating?
It got a little frustrating. Yeah. But then again, you know, we did rework a few things.
Yeah.
But yes, it was like, we must get this done for this amount of, you know, because it needs to be out around November.
Yeah. He also improved technology. Like, he made the camera spiral all the way around. And
with
out,
that, the robotic camera, which was super cool.
Yeah. But the color is amazing. I think the color is like one of the way that part of it really feels like this weird Florida palette. Yeah. And that does pop. And it's interesting. But it's really, I think of the last like 20 years, it's probably the craziest art thing that's gotten made.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is,
people don't understand that. I just was like, it's just a weird art thing.
Well, then Haneke did it too. Yeah. And what's fascinating is it has the same problems, and it's his own movie. Yeah. Like, when I watch the American Funny Games, all the things that don't work about it are because he didn't adapt to a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The politeness that worked for Europe doesn't work for America. And so I found it's an okay movie, but it doesn't work the way the other one does. And so it's a very interesting, this idea of doing an exact remake, maybe this is the sign that just doesn't work. I don't know. You know,
it's but like isn't a it funny concept. That we still discuss it?
Where oh, no, it's fascinating.
Yeah. It's still got a lot of stuff to it.
And probably does. Like, I mean, I'd be curious to hear people who weren't so... didn't know the original at all, like a different generation. If that was their first segue into Psycho, it'd be fascinating to know what they feel and think about.
Yeah.
That's a whole different, you know,
question.
I don't know.
Well, I know you had fun on that gig for sure.
Yes, for sure.
But what about in terms of the release, like what did it do for you in your career?
Well, it was big. I mean, you know, that was back when they put full page ads in the newspaper and your name was on it. And as soon as that ad came out in the LA Times or Variety or whatever it was like I got all these agents calling me. So that was really exciting.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
And like interviews for films that I knew I'd never get, but I got to interview for American Beauty. And it's Gus Van Sant's editor. I was like, okay.
Yeah, that's cool. Ride that out.
Yeah. Do you believe me?
Who did do American Beauty?
I think Tariq Anwar ended up doing American Beauty. Okay, yeah, wow. There were two people on that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the first thing you did go from there without IMDb?
Oh gosh, I think it was Rodrigo Garcia's movie.
Oh, okay, yeah, he's
good. Things you can tell. Yeah,
just tell by looking at her.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So that was his first feature.
Yeah. And so you were in the feature world for several years.
Yes.
But was there TV as well, or did you eventually transition to TV?
I transitioned into TV, although when I worked on season one of Big Love, and then I went back to doing features for a little while. I really liked working on Big Love. It was really fun, and I just thought, oh, television, it's very collaborative, and there are a bunch of people. And
which one do you prefer more? Because they're very different things. Like film, it's very much like summer camp for a couple of months where everybody's there together. Yeah. And it's very much like this team thing. TV, I've discovered, it's like it's a machine that's running.
It's
and you
machine.
Might step in for a month, but then you step right back out. And that machine's just going to keep on going.
Yeah.
So.
So, you know, it's like I like working on HBO shows because they're a little calmer. You
know? A show I love is I just didn't realize you did it till the second is In Treatment.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that show was hypnotic. It could have been boring. And
it's
oh, my God.
It's never boring.
So good. In the psych, Gabriel Byrne's office.
I know.
Yeah, that was a really good show.
And then I got into, like I did The Killing, which was like the first show where I had to do act breaks. You know, and
it
was
like, ooh,
was that first season or
that was season one and two?
Yeah, that was good.
And then I did a little show. You know, so the TV thing just started rolling. That was when peak TV started to happen, and I started to ride that train. And so then I tried doing network television, which I just did not like because that is a machine. It's just That was too hard. I did that after Dexter.
Yeah. A couple of things there.
Yeah.
And then also, like a few one-offs like Scream and American Gods and things like that. So what's the difference between coming in and doing an episode of a show as opposed to if you're there for something like The Killing, which was like two seasons worth?
Yeah. Doing that episode of Scream was so much fun.
Whose episode did you do again?
I did Ty West.
Oh, excellent.
No, I love Ty. That was just really fun. Mm. It was just like, oh, yay. I get to have a few scares. And the kids in that show were so funny and great.
I guess that does bring up an interesting thing about editing is genre. Like, how do you feel about editing horror when you're creating suspense and shocks or jump scares and comedy, which have often been compared, right? But to dramas, like, what is it just like fun because it's like working out in different ways for
you? It is. It's just exercising different things. Like Hunters, I get
everything.
Action-packed. It was everything. And it was really fun because it's just like torture and then
because there's also an A story set in the prison and then you're also getting to go to these very like very sad
dark.
Very real places
going
to like the camps and everything, but I love doing genre things like that. It was just really fun. And then like going to American Gods, it was just supposed to be one episode, and it's going to be so easy. And I ended up staying 7 months.
Wow.
So because I got – what happened was I did one episode, and then I inherited another episode, and then we put those two episodes together and made one episode. And so it just – that was a weird
– I still haven't seen that. That show looked really cool. And
it's wild.
Season one, yeah.
Really good.
I enjoyed it. Brian Fuller.
Yeah. And Neil Gaiman's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got some really cool imagery in it, like visuals, the way that it's constructed. It's really surrealist. That's fine.
Interesting show.
What about the – I mean, obviously, this is how you guys met on the Dexter years.
Yes.
But what was – like being on a show for a long period of time, does that – obviously increases your ownership of the world, I would imagine.
It was funny because I came in on Dexter at the last two seasons and – I was embraced by this wonderful family. Like, it was such a great experience because, like, if you came in, if you come in on a show towards the end and there have been people there since the beginning, like one of the editors, Louis Chiaffi, had been there since season two. And, he's the boss.
Mm.
And
I love Louis.
Yeah. I love Louis.
And he's the one that went on to do a bunch of Adam Wingard stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I was just like, embraced by this family, and you just get sucked into the whole world. And I just remember, like, my first episode, I could not stop watching, like, Michael and Jennifer and, like, their dailies. And I was just like, this is wow.
Well, was that a situation where you were actually a fan watching
until
you jumped in? So,
that's
gotta be weird.
It's weird, Like, In Treatment was the same way, too, because I came in on the last season and,
But you already know the rhythm.
But I knew the rhythm, so... And that was one of the things about Dexter. I guess, they were like, you really know how to do this show. It's amazing. For the first, first episode, I was like, well, it has been on for 6 seasons. There is a template, and I've watched all of them.
Do you have to emulate? I mean, do you feel the need to, I have to keep it consistent so it feels like the previous?
No. I managed to do the way I cut things together, and I managed to make it dextry. It was all really about the point of view, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, that's the show. It's all Dexter's point of view.
Yeah.
And I feel like they're all, as long as you keep that point of view.
His point of view is changing as he's growing.
And it's like it could be a scene with other characters and it's still Dexter. You have to just think Dexter's there listening.
What in terms of, it could be any of the shows, but with Dexter in particular, TV is such a writer's medium.
Yes.
Right? So what's the process like on a show? You get all the footage. You have the scripts. Are you mostly communicating with the writers, the producers on that particular episode, the director of that episode? Like who directs you to that first cut?
You know, the first cut, I followed the script because it's like that's the thing. And the director is usually – in television, the director is usually shooting the script too. that's one thing. And when they're not, there's big problems.
All right.
Yeah. So then you get, then you have a few days with the director, and then it becomes like, the producers and the showrunners show, and you're carving it to be the thing that they picture it to be. So.
And also, it moves so fast, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which is, the thing I wanted to ask about in terms of that versus Hunters. Hunters is a show that every episode dropped all at once.
Yes.
So does that put more pressure on you when you're working on something like that where you have to deliver all 10 at a time, whereas, a show that's every week, you have a little bit of time to really figure out?
It does. It's weird pressure. It slows people down. And then other people have to speed up. So
and there's no feedback from the public.
Right.
No.
So you're kind of just hoping the whole thing.
No idea. It's weird.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
For binge watching, when you drop those all at one time, it's just like, here it is.
Hopefully it worked the first one. The first episode's a very strong one because of the nature of the surprise of the whole kind of subgenre almost.
No, and you're making bingeable television. So it's like you want to be able to, you want them to watch the next one.
Yeah.
I think I watched it in 4 days and I've only watched 2 TV shows this whole year. Like I usually watch movies, but that I watched, I told you, in about 3 days because once I was in, I was like, okay, I need to see this whole story.
No, you want to know like what's going to happen. Yeah. That's what I kept saying to them. I was like, this show's crazy, but you want to know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So
I love Jews killing Nazis. It's like,
sure.
It's just one of those
pleasures.
That's
why I was just like, sign me up.
I'm like, my grandmother would be proud as I'm watching. I'm like, hell yes. But no, it's, I think it's funny because it's surprising some of the subgenres in there when it goes to the comic book moment or a musical moment or like a grindhouse, like literally feels like a grindhouse trailer for a moment. And you're like, okay.
There's like a musical number in the third episode.
Yeah.
Really
where they do
Staying
Alive.
Yeah.
I was like,
that was beautiful.
Yeah. And it's like it can be distracting and pull you out momentarily, but then I think if you keep going with it, it kind of builds into what it is,
which
is just a different thing, which is fun. And and it's grounded by great performances. So.
Well, what's funny is you've done a lot of work throughout the career, but does divisiveness affect you at all? Because obviously Psycho is a divisive movie.
Yeah.
Hunters is divisive. Yeah. Dexter was divisive for those last couple of years. How does that affect
you? Oh, Gus Van Sant's work has always got some sort of division.
Always.
Yeah. Naturally, yeah.
Does that affect you at all as an editor, like when you're approaching the material, or it's just like, whatever, this is what we're trying to do? Because
it's a lot of whatever. You're like, I was doing my job.
But maybe it's more like, are you drawn personally just to material that is like
absolutely
taking edge? Yeah.
No, and the blowback on Hunters, like from the Auschwitz Museum, I disagree.
Oh, I didn't hear this part.
I heard this. It was a big thing on NPR about this.
Okay. That happened with Inglourious.
It's not historically accurate, and therefore it's kind of, aping on or exploiting.
Exploiting. Well, David Weil, the showrunner, he didn't want to have people's stories happen. He didn't want to film those. He wanted to just have things that, would have happened. And they took offense at that. And I was like, no.
Yeah. Well, it's also knowing what you're buying. You're watching something that's pulp genre.
No, exactly.
Your wish fulfillment, right? And it's very clear with what it is at the start. It's like, that's what I'm doing. It's the same way, but people have the same issues with all of Quentin's work, right?
Yes,
they pick every one of them and say, well, that's not accurate. It's like, but he never promised you accuracy.
No.
That's why we have documentaries. You can watch Night and Fog, and trust me, it's not a good time, but it's a great movie. It's a different thing.
That's what David said. He's like, this is not a documentary. This is like...
Yeah,
me telling my grandma's stories and putting my spin on them. And
have you ever been on a show where, like, I'm curious, like, had Hunters been a whatever a 10-week run, right? And there was outcry right from the beginning. Like, would that have altered what the later episodes were? So, has that ever happened on a show before? Were you on something and reaction to it kind of altered the course of the later episodes?
No.
Yeah, because once you have them all written, you're pretty much kind of locked, right?
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's going in this one direction, and you're just going there.
Can't change anything.
You kind of can't change anything.
Do you think if I challenged you, right? Like if I said to you, I'm going to give you $20,000, take the footage of Psycho, but forget the timing. Just take all the footage, edit it however you want. Do you think that could have felt like a very contemporary? Because I almost wonder, you know, because you've got the material and you've got – there's so much there.
No, can I go back?
I mean, the material must still
edit
exist.
Edit the story.
I kind of want an editor's
make
cut
it
now.
Make it last like
– podcast
really
slash
fun.
Editor forced cut.
That would be really, weird. Really fun.
It'll be but like I do think 64 the material, minutes long.
Yeah.
Because I think it is the timing, you know? Yeah. I'm like, hey, it'd be good.
Rob, he knows me too well.
82 minutes.
I will make this short.
For TV.
Yeah.
Well, something I didn't know you did – which I also want to bring. Speaking of divisive, did you guys know there was a Rosemary Baby
TV show?
Yeah, I watched it. I watched both.
You did? Yeah. Well, Amy edited these. So
I edited one part.
One of them?
Part
how
one.
Was it? Part one or part two.
You're asking me that with the
which
editor.
One
no,
was
no.
It?
I mean, like, how was it working
it was
on
not,
how
it? Was not a fun experience, actually. It was not fun. It was not fun.
And what was the gig there? Because I remember when it aired, but I don't remember watching it. So this was not like the Van Sant thing. They were just trying to do a modern take on that
book. I think somebody
book.
Had the option to do, you know, to remake Rosemary's Baby. Mm. And they really, like, NBC needed something to fill some slot.
Yeah.
And so they, like, just threw
two
money
part,
at
that's
it.
That's
yeah.
hard to do
me,
that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was interested. It was like Zoe Saldana. Like, really interesting people were involved. And, like, Agnieszka Holland, who I had worked with on The Killing, she, you know, she brought me on. And it ended up, like, being a horrible experience.
Okay.
But that's okay.
and that's
but even like the horror, it was too much for, you know, network television. I mean, that was like the whole other thing. It's like you can show buckets of blood, but you can't show side boob. And so, you know, she had this whole scene with, you know,
side
the
boob.
Devil.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, impregnating, you know, Rosemary. And I was like, what is, you know. It's very.
But a PG, G version.
It had to be the no side boob version.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was weird.
Devil doesn't like side boob.
No. But you watched it.
I did. I was looking for the side boob.
Yeah.
That's why
I
signed up.
I mean, I was drawn to it just because I was like, okay, yeah, let's see how they take a whack at Rosemary's Baby again.
Well, and you were in the journalism world at that point, right? So I remember all that. Yeah.
Did it make it through?
But also,
season?
Zoe. Zoe had just done a.
No, it was just two episodes.
It was two episodes.
But I remember Zoe had just done like a. She did a solo action. She was like the lead woman of a like a kind of a hitman action movie that I thought she was really great in. And this was before Guardians as well, I think.
Yeah. Oh,
So it was just like kind of watching her trajectory as an actress. And I was like, oh, wow, she's going to slip into Mia Farrow's shoes. Let's
and she was and she, great.
She did what she could.
I mean, she did what she could with the part.
Exactly.
I love her.
Yeah.
I thought it was great that they cast her. Yeah. You know.
Very weird.
She was,
it was a weird experiment.
I love
when they do those kinds of experiments. They're like, well, let's do it on television. There's light risk. Let's just play around with that.
We'll put it out on Mother's Day.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. Yes,
oh,
yes.
Did they do that?
Oh, yes,
oh,
they did.
But it's hard with genre because a movie like that, like you think you're remaking it, but you're forgetting that it's already been remade probably 47 times in the genre. Same with Exorcist. All those classics became the tentpole. So when you get to the remake, now these kind of things feel old. Like it doesn't feel as biting. You'd have to come up with a very different twist on it. All right, but the first resume, the way that film's put together is something else, you know? Yeah, but sorry,
very much.
We didn't do that one. So we'll save that for a different podcast. Yeah. So. There's an interview we'll never be doing on the show. Can't think why. Moving on.
What are some of the genre things, either TV or film, that you've been watching lately? Like what kind of stuff turns you on and stuff?
Well, let's see. I've been watching a lot of comedies because I have a 15-year-old daughter. Yeah, it's a dark time, and she, you know, loves watching sitcoms, which is really funny.
Wait, 15-year-olds to watch sitcoms? That's okay.
I did when I was 15.
Yeah, I mean, that's all I watched when I was
when you're young,
like,
it's thing about
we had MASH and
Cheers. Empty Nest and Cheers.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess it's Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is like the whole, you know, in like good, like these aren't sitcoms, they're Mike Schur shows, but.
The new version of it,
You know, she'll watch Parks and Rec till the cows come
home. I will watch Parks and Rec till the cows come home, so
we watch a lot of that. And what do I watch when I'm not working on, you know, I started rewatching Hannibal.
Yes.
I don't know.
Oh, the show.
Oh,
that show's great.
I started rewatching. Yeah. I have to get through season 3.
It's good.
No, I know. I got to get there. Yeah. I rewatched The Sopranos.
That's one I've been meaning to go back to as well.
It's awesome.
I think I missed like four and five. How many seasons was it? Five or
there
six?
There were six.
I missed a middle chunk there.
It's a good chunk.
Yeah, there's somewhere Steve Buscemi directs and they're just like, why is that guy not directing more movies? Yeah. Like he was great.
No, it's such a great show. And it's, it was like 1999.
Yeah.
And
trailblazed it. Yeah.
Oh my God. That was a good period.
Yeah.
Anything coming up that you can talk about?
I'm working on an HBO show that Kate Winslet is in, and she plays this cop in Pennsylvania, and so it's a part that you haven't really seen her do.
Is it Killing-esque or that kind of genre?
It's Killing. It's very Killing-esque.
So excellent. Cool.
Yeah, it's a family drama with a murder mystery thrown into it. Yeah. It's called Mayor of Easttown. They may change the name, but
that sounds awesome. Yeah.
It's got a great cast. Uh-huh. It's like, you know.
So. How long are you on that? Is it just a single episode? Or
It's 3 episodes, and there's 2 of us, 2 editors, and I'll be on it till hopefully the end of summer.
Cool.
So, yeah. But so it's nice to kind of get back into this kind of quiet genre after the killing of Nazis hunters.
It's pretty out of control.
I was just like, a nice – cops looking for evidence.
A little bit procedural.
Take me there.
the true crime stuff has never lost its popularity.
Never.
Like in podcasts, it's number one, right?
Oh,
it's like king of podcasting.
No, I go in my assistant's room. That's what she's listening to.
Yeah, TV books. It's true crime
podcast.
And that's what I will always watch. Anytime they release those Making of a Murderer-esque documentaries on Netflix, I'm going to watch the whole thing that night.
As people who get into true crime, doesn't it ever feel repetitive or is it just constantly keeping you on your toes?
Something that's crazy enough to have a whole thing structured around it, then it's not. There's usually something crazy. Even like McMillions, which is on HBO now, which was not a murder mystery in any way. You know, it's a 6-part series, but it's just done so captivating.
Scandalous.
It's really fun to watch.
Yeah, you know who did it by the first episode. You're like, it was that guy. But even still, it's like all everything. It's like onions with them peeling layers.
You're like, but that guy, he's so skeezy.
It has to be the skeezy guy.
Yeah, that's been a fun show to watch.
I've enjoyed that so much. I still have the final episode sitting on my television at home, and I can't wait to go home.
Have you seen
Don't
Fuck with Cats?
Not yet. I've heard that one's really bleak.
I heard it's a little. If you're a pet lover like myself, it's like you have to be a little sensitive around it. But there's like you just get past it, and then it's people taking internet justice into their own hands.
Yeah.
I do love that if you in any way upset a cat on the internet, people are going to hunt you down.
Yes, they are.
And find you.
Yeah.
So, that is internet justice. So.
That's pretty wild. Have you watched Outsider yet? We were talking about that before.
I did not watch Outsider.
It's excellent.
Tyler, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not like anything I've seen.
I have two coworkers who worked on it, and they're like, Outsider.
Yeah. Because they won't watch it too much.
Yeah, well, yeah, because they just hate it, because they, you know, worked on it too long. But I was like, come on. All these people love it. And he's like, oh, I don't know why. It's great. <Wow. laughs>
They're not coming back for season two.
Yeah, no, they, you know.
If there is, I don't even know if there is.
That's not true.
I know. I think everyone
feels that way, though.
No, but it's a very stripped-back, realistic version of a King thing, which I've never really seen. Usually it's got that kind of, it's something that's become his thing, almost, of Americana. This feels real.
Yeah. It's also,
I'm
going to watch it.
Yeah.
Despite my coworkers.
Yeah, it feels a lot more bleak and intense. It's not Kids on Bikes, which we see, and it's not like this adolescent story of my cat dying or
the
evil clowns.
It's grown-ups.
Yeah, it's gnarly, but it's great. Really good stuff. Well, thank you, Amy, for coming on the show.
Oh, absolutely.
For joining us tonight.
Thank you for editing.
For the last evening on Earth.
Asking me about editing. Oh, yeah, right, thanks.
He keeps doing that. Say,
we got to talk about Psycho on the last evening. That's fine. We're good.
And we'll have you back when you do the re-edit of Psycho.
That's right.
I'm in. Let's go watch. I just want to look through all the film. Oh, my God. I'm just so curious. I'm just like, as an experiment, again, it's just curiosity what these things got. Like, if you got to mess with it, what would it look like?
I would love to see what you would do with no restriction. Like, just do it. Just edit it.
No, this would be the note. It'd be like, but Michael Bay. So Michael Bay's hired you to re-edit Psycho. What would that look like?
Triple cutting.
You know, right, you have the material.
Get Gus on the phone and get
explosions.
It going.
Yeah, exactly.
It needs a lot more explosions, that's for sure. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us.
And Hunters is now on Amazon, so you can watch all 10 episodes.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Episodes 2, 5, and 9.
The rest is expendable.
And we will be back next week. I've determined it.
What?
Yeah. We're gonna be back next week.
That's really throwing my apocalyptic.
I know. You spent the whole episode saying this is the last episode.
Oh, jinx. I
mean, how about we just say we'll see?
We'll see you. How about we'll see you next week?
All right.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network. Hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Terrick, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Sanye, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pacetta, and Rob Galuzzo.